Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. On this podcast, we present a session from the EDUCAUSE 2012 annual conference. The presentation is entitled Student Success at Scale. What have we learned from applying technology to persistent challenges? Our speaker is Josh Jarrett, Deputy Director for Education of Post-Secondary Success at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Oh, got some reminders here. All right, good afternoon. That was everyone, a little afternoon lull here. So I'm quite excited to be here with you. This is a great opportunity for me to play back what I get to hear in my job. I go around the country and I see what innovative people and institutions are doing. Many of the folks are in this room. And then I get to come here and say, here's what you guys are all doing. And so I'm going to share some of those examples today. And these are all things that I see happening at scale. Institutions who are doing these things with thousands of students. These are not things that are just R&D anymore. They are increasingly moving into real use with real students. And I would argue that if you're not having the conversations about these things on your campus, you're increasingly going to be behind the curve. And so these are the things that I see leading institutions doing and want to share back. So these three things are Bigfoot, Goldilocks, and moonshots. Pretty straightforward, right? I'm going to explain to you what I mean by each of those three things. Before I do, I want to give a little context for why these things matter. But these are different types of strategies that institutions are using. So I'm going to give a little background, and then I'm going to explain what these three things are. And then I'd like to leave you with a challenge, I think, for all of us as we think about how technology can improve learning and student outcomes. So let me just give a little bit of context. I'm not a career educator. I sort of have a mixed background of time in the private sector and the public sector, inside education, outside education. But I've been doing this work for 5 or 6 years and have been kind of integrating different worlds. And you see some of my motivations there. Those are my three sons, Jackson, Keegan, and Jonah. And so Jackson's six now. So I've got an internal time clock in my head. I've got 12 years to figure all this stuff out. So I hope you'll help me in that. So let me start at about 100,000 feet. What am I really going to talk about today? And I think this quote from the mayor of San Antonio sums it up in many respects, right? That the American dream is not a sprint, it's not a marathon, but it's a relay. And it's a relay between generations. And that's really the work that the foundation is really founded on, the principle that all lives have equal value and everyone should be able to live a happy, healthy, and productive life. So when we think about what does this mean in the United States, you say, I want to think about that, the intergenerational story of the American dream. What defines opportunities you go across generations? So let me begin with the question, which is, if you're born poor in this country, what's the one thing that you want to control about your circumstances of your birth? Do you want to control the color of your skin, the geography of your birth, whether you have one parent in the household, two parents in the household, the health status of people in your family? Turns out, you'd want to pick the education of your parents. So this is an 8-point font slide. We'll try and go through a bunch of these things very fast. I'll make sure these slides are available. But what this really says is, for people who are born into low-income families in this country, if you escape poverty, what is it that helps make that possible? And the biggest bar on the left is the education of your parents. It trumps all the other effects. So when we think about our work in education, it's really about a pathway to opportunity as one of the core missions of higher ed. Now, what else do we know about this? We know that education is not equitably distributed. So this chart tells us from 1970 to just a few years ago, what's the probability that you will earn a bachelor's degree by age 24. If you're in the top income quartile, we've almost doubled that, 40%, now it's 77. You know, 4 out of 5 people in that cohort will get a bachelor's degree. If you're born in the bottom income quartile, you have a 10% chance. Right? It's 8 times more likely to get a bachelor's degree if you're born in the upper income quartile. So that's a big part of our work, which is how do we address that challenge. And it's not just about equity, it's also about the economy. Folks have seen this data from Georgetown University. If you look at how our economy is changing and the type of jobs that we need, We'll see that in 1973, 28% of jobs required some college or more. By the end of the decade, it'll be 65% will require some college or more. So how are we doing on college attainment? Well, 20, 30 years ago, it was about 40%. 20 years ago, it was 40%. 10 years ago, it was 40%. And right now, it's 40%. 40% of adults in this country have an associate's degree or above. And that's in the generation that's now 55 to 64 years old, on the left side of this chart, that was good for best in the world. In the 1980s, we had the most educated populace in the country, in the world. Now, if you look at our 25 to 34-year-olds, it's still about 40%, but now a number of institutions have passed us by. So it's not that we're getting worse, it's that everybody is investing in education, and we're seeing a big change. And in fact, we in Germany are the only two countries for whom the generation of 25 to 34-year-olds is worse educated than their parents' generation. Right? You see 42%, now we're down to 40%. So we're actually, either in best case, we're static. So that, in many ways, is what are the challenges that we're here at the 50,000, 100,000 foot level. When we talk about how are we going to do this at the higher ed level, I'm going to quickly go through this context. People have, the Moody's presentation just a moment ago talked about some of these things, so I'm going to be very quick. But three challenges around access, quality, and costs. So in access, we've actually done a very good job in this country of promoting access to higher ed. We've seen enrollment growth. We've seen more and more low-income students, first-generation students, children of immigrants attending higher ed. But there are some concerns about whether or not that's flattening. In California community colleges, there are 470,000 students on the waiting list. 470,000 students on the waiting list. They say, I get that I need higher ed to get ahead in this country, to participate in the economy, as in the society. Sign me up. And we say, sorry, there's not room. We're also starting to see in some states higher ed enrollment start to drop, which is just data from a week ago. There's also other constraints that are happening here, which is the hidden constraints of, well, we let students in, but there just aren't courses available. We've had to cut back on sections. So 40 to 50% of students report having been unable to enroll in a course because of enrollment caps. Those courses were full. So why does it take 3 or 4 years to complete an associate's degree, and why does it take 5 or 6 years to complete a bachelor's degree? Well, this is part of that challenge. And we also know that students are changing. 75% of students are now defined as non-traditional by the Department of Ed. Right? You don't go right after high school. You don't attend full-time. You're not dependent on your parents. And so we know that the new normal is a non-traditional student. Let's talk a little bit about quality. Lots of ways to measure it. None of them perfect. If you look at completion rates, 53% of students who go to higher ed in 5 years will earn a credential. That's just over a 50-50 shot. That's a flip of the coin whether or not you'll get to the goal there. And it varies by type of institution, not surprisingly. So this is a dirty secret that I think is getting more and more attention, but it's certainly one that we know there's students who are saying, I think I've got the will. How do we show them the way? If you look at particular problems, dig in a little bit deeper. If you look at developmental education, which is a big challenge. 60% of community college students, almost 30% of four-year students show up not ready to do college level, either math, writing, or reading. If you test three levels deep in math, you have a 10% chance of passing a math gatekeeper course. 10%. So this is where dreams go to die. So how are we going to address that? What are we also learning in class? So folks have seen it academically adrift. There's reasons to be critical of it. But certainly there's the things that we have to pay attention to. 45% of students demonstrating no significant gains in critical thinking, analytical reasoning, and written communication during the first 2 years. We also go ask the employers and say, well, what are you finding with your graduates? Not well prepared in global knowledge, self-direction, writing, critical thinking. Right? So there's a lot of things that we've got to address around quality. Costs. This is the tuition and fees data, up 439% since the early 80s, twice the pace of healthcare growth, cost of healthcare, and about four times the inflation. Now, we know that's not all driven by rising costs. This is a big driver of it. States are disinvesting in higher education. Not only are their budgets under pressure, but they have certain obligations around healthcare, prisons, K-12 education. Even when the tax receipts start to recover, we think the long-term outlook for state funding of higher education is not a pretty one. We've seen a 13% drop in the per student funding in the last 5 years. So if you're in North Dakota or Wyoming, anyone from North Dakota or Wyoming? All right, the rest of us, we should reason to be concerned. But here's an interesting thing about the actual cost structure. So if you look at where the costs are changing, it's probably hard to see some of those other pictures there, sorry, some of the lines. But if you look at where the costs are actually changing, if you look at the public two-year and the public four-year sector, those have only grown 1% and 6% respectively. So in many cases, public institutions are doing a very admirable job keeping their costs under control. And in many ways, those increases in tuition are driven by the state cuts. But the reality is students, the public politicians, are still seeing the net effect on students. We heard about kind of the tuition cap in the last session that people were here for that, in terms of, are we reaching the tipping point of being able to raise tuition? You know, this is the line of student debt, which is three or four times what it was just at the beginning a decade ago. And it's surpassed credit card debt. So three challenges, three contexts. These are the big macro issues that I think we all have to grapple with solutions for. And I want to, before I tell you some of the exciting, promising things that make me quite optimistic, despite the story I just told, I want to also just bring it down one level deeper, which is to talk a little about what it means for students. So I want to tell a story about a real person. A woman named Brianna. That's not her real picture, but she is a real person. She decided to go. She's from Wisconsin. She's a pretty good student in high school, decided to go to community college. She wanted to be a veterinarian. She's going to get an associate's degree and transfer. And these researchers asked her at the beginning of the fall semester, what is your bet on finishing college? And she said, 100%. I get it. I get the American dream passes through these institutions. I'm part of that. You know, she had to pay about $15,000. She got some from mom and dad. She got some Pell Grants, other loans. And she still had to work to pay the rest of that. So she took 12 credit hours, and she worked 30 hours a week. This is what her schedule was. She'd wake up early. She'd commute to school. She had to live really far away to find a place with a low enough rent that she could afford. She'd attend class. She'd go to her first job. Then she'd go back to school. She'd attend class again. She'd go to her second job. Then she'd come back home. And she was so stressed at the end of the day, she'd take a muscle relaxant just to get some sleep. And you don't see much time in here for homework, reading, reflection, etc. So this is what happened. She'd fall asleep. She'd do the head bob. She'd wake up in a puddle of drool. She got a D, C, D, and a withdrawal. And she was asked to leave the veterinary technician program. In a matter of weeks, right, she went from 100% guaranteed I'm going to finish college to I got dismissed from my program. And she reflects on what was it like to be dismissed. She said, wow, it was almost kind of like a relief, because she knew it wasn't sustainable, what she was trying to do. But she felt like she failed. She hit rock bottom. She thought she was never going to get anywhere, and there's really no hope for the future. That is an amazing accomplishment in one short semester, to go that far from 100%. And she really said, the bottom was scary. So she left school. She ended up moving to live with her dad in Texas, and she's thinking about enrolling in the military. She joined the military. She's maybe going to join, go back to school at some point in the future. And the only people who really found her down in Texas is her student loan folks, who now are after for the debt that she left with. So that's the reality of these challenges when it comes to real students. So let me ask the last question before we dive into some good news, which is, how ready are we to deal with these challenges? And there's a great report, if you haven't seen it, called the Iron Triangle, that the Lumina Foundation funded. And it really says that cost, quality, and access are locked in an iron triangle. We cannot improve one without negatively affecting the other two. Well, those are the three challenges we have. We have to get better on all three of those. We can't improve, we can improve one at a time, it's going to hurt the other ones. That's really, there's two solutions for why that'd be the case. One, for the economists in the room, that's Pareto optimal. We are perfectly optimal. We've optimized every resource, every dollar in the system, and we cannot get any better. Any votes for that solution? All right. The other, though, is that we've created a system that's hard to change. We've diffused decision-making, constrained resources, policies, and multiple levels. So I like to say this is another way to tell the story, right? Which is, how did the Lilliputians hold Gulliver down? They were smaller than him, but they had 1,000 little ropes. And I feel like sometimes we got 1,000 little ropes on us. And so if we cut one or two, the giant's not going to be able to get up. We've got to figure out ways to free a leg, free an arm, do a little bit more. And I think that we're seeing people who are doing that, taking on these challenges very seriously and doing them in systemic ways, thinking about scale. So now I'm actually going to tell you what these three innovations are. So I'm going to start with Bigfoot. All right. So I live in the Pacific Northwest. We call them Sasquatch up there. But really, this is a question of, does something exist which we all have been looking for a long period of time? And I would say that something is, can we produce undeniably better learning outcomes at repeatably lower costs? Right? If we can do that, we can start to unlock new ways of allocating our resources of student success. And I think that I'm here to report back from the land of Sasquatch that I think we've got some plaster foot casings and some grainy photos and some little video where I think the evidence is building up that the answer to this question is yes. I'm not ready to declare that Sasquatch exists, but I think it's promising. And I think guys like Bill Bowen, who know a lot more about education than I certainly do, basically says that he thinks now is the time, that the technology's matured enough, that the solutions are there, that we really can deliver quality learning outcomes at an affordable price. And so I think we're starting to see examples of this. And this is not about technology, first and foremost. It's about pedagogy, and it's about what we know about learning. So this you can tell is a really old study, and I deliberately don't update the chart because it's important to know. This is Benjamin Bloom from 1984, who looked at traditional classroom instruction versus alternative models, mastery-based learning and one-on-one tutoring with mastery-based learning. Right? One-on-one tutoring with mastery-based learning was 2 standard deviations higher than a traditional classroom instruction. So we have known for decades that traditional classroom instruction is the suboptimal approach. We just can't afford to do anything different. Unless we want to give everybody a governess, which is one option, how do we get to this one-on-one tutoring? And so that's what people have been pursuing, many folks in this room. And we'd like to think about this sort of this loop of learning, that until we get visibility into the learning outcomes that students intended to learn, how we represent that in terms of the student, a unique student profile, individual to that student, how we provide the right type of learning experience and environments for that student, and use assessment to figure out, are we making progress or not? What else does that student need to learn? This closed loop, that's the self-improving formula that many folks are trying to get to. And so let me give some examples of people who are doing this. So folks may be familiar with Carnegie Mellon's Open Learning Initiative. They call this a learning curve. So I thought learning curves were supposed to go up, right? Turns out this one goes down. And what this really is on the y-axis is the number of hints or wrong answers that students had in their digital tutor. And on the x-axis is the number of opportunities they had to demonstrate competency in a particular skill. So what does this curve tell us? Right? They're actually learning something, right? The fewer hints, fewer wrong answers, the more chances. And so that positive feedback loop is working. So if you have a curve that starts high and stays high, that means the students aren't mastering the concept. And that's what they use to empower faculty to go into the classroom and say, how do I spend my scarce time? Right? Our faculty time with students is probably the most precious time we have. How do we use that most efficiently and effectively? Well, it should be on the concepts that people are getting stuck on. Or it should be on the higher order thinking skills that can't be captured in some kind of digital tutor like this. And so Ithaca just finished a random control trial looking at Carnegie Mellon's Open Learning Initiative courseware in blended format in major public universities and community colleges. And they looked and they said, well, is there any difference? And they look at the bars, there's no difference. And they said, this is a very accurate zero. Right? We did random assignment, hundreds of thousands of students involved, and there really isn't a difference. And so we can say with confidence that at least we're able to produce, in this case, a statistics course by OLI, the same or better learning outcomes. The students spent 25% less time, and they modeled out some of the potential cost savings from different faculty models that you could use around these types of solutions, and found very significant potential resource efficiencies. So I can't quite say clearly better learning outcomes for an affordable price, but this suggests that we might be getting close. Let me give another example. I talked about developmental education. This is the work of the National Center for Academic Transformation. Many people know Carol Twigg's work. This is the work where they found 50% increase in student success and 30% reduction in cost. A lot of this riffing off the Virginia Tech Emporium model. All right, they're doing this with 100,000 students and 30-plus community colleges. And many states, like Virginia and North Carolina, are rolling out models like this at scale. So course by course developmental education may be an artifact 3 years from now. Maybe something we go to museums to go look for, because we're going to do these much more mastery-based. By the time you get to college, your knowledge is much more like Swiss cheese than an empty bucket. We just got to figure out where the holes are and help you fill those. Another example, NROC Math, the National Repository of Online Courses. They are developing interactive, engaging content, making it available as an open educational resource. They're designing it for low-income students and students of color. So they've done these. You see the presentation in the middle there. They screen tested over 25 actors to find the right presenter that would resonate with those students and connect with them, because actually the learning gains that they made were dependent on whether or not they connected with the presenter. So they're doing this kind of R&D work to develop this kind of experiences. Arizona State University partnered with Newton. 5,000 students in their remedial math program. Right, their withdrawal rates dropped 50%. Their pass rates went up about 10%. Half the class finished early, and their cost went way down for this, because this is an adaptive learning application. So we're seeing this happen a lot more in developmental education, where the intention is, how do we get students up to college ready as fast as possible? And so the question is, what happens in more of the college-level courses? And the resistance has been much more significant there. And so there are a lot of, it's still faculty by faculty member. And so one of the things that might carry this type of instructional model into may or may not be MOOCs. So it's not in this version, but in version 2.0 or 3.0, how do you actually think about MOOCs not as some independent learning experience, but how do you think about it as a tool for flipping your classroom? Something that's different than a textbook, but has more functionality, has embedded interactivity, has the social effect. And so we're particularly interested in MOOCs as a tool for blended learning, and less so as an independent learner online. We can come back and talk about that in the Q&A if we have time. Let me see how we're doing on time here. Okay, so we're going to pick it up a little bit. Goldilocks. Remember Goldilocks? Not too hot, not too cold, not too soft, not too hard. All right, this section is about choice for students and the guided pathways that get them on a path that is more likely to succeed than to be a flip of a coin whether or not they make it through. So I'm going to offend you all with an oversimplified version of students' progression through your institutions. And I warn you now, this is going to be so oversimplified than the student's reality. I don't want to offend anybody or hurt anyone's feelings, but this is a really simple version of what it looks like for students to go through institutions. All right, so it's a joke, right? So let me explain what this is. So some researchers looked at entering students in a four-year college and said, based just on the number of credit hours they were taking, not the courses, not the majors, right? That's why this is so simplified. And down the left side, there's four tracks. You're on the four-year track because you're taking enough credit hours, you'll graduate in 4 years. The five-year track, the six-year track, or you're nearly not on a track at all. And you can see across four semesters, the big numbers in those circles is how many students were in those bubbles. And the lines are where students went for the next semester. And so you can start to see they go all over the place. And if you look across the top row, 39.1% were on the four-year track at the beginning. And at the end of four semesters, turns out 29% were still on the four-year track. That's not bad, right? Look at the little box to the right. Only 6.6% of students were consistently on the four-year track. They were on these arrows going up, down, all around, right? So that's the oversimplified version. Now, what if you think about students' majors, switching majors? If you thought about the course-taking patterns, think about the course catalog and the number of permutations and combinations through that course catalog. Now imagine that you're a first-generation student that doesn't have someone to help you guide through that, yourself through that. Now imagine you're an institution that has about 1,000-to-1 student-to-advisor ratio. And you wonder why students aren't getting through. If you look at the courses themselves, we estimate that over 50% of community college courses aren't the minimum courses for degree completers to get through. They're either courses taken by folks who drop out, courses taken over the credit limit, courses taken they end up failing and having to retake. Over 50% of the 2 years, and it's about 35% at the 4 year. So we're starting to see examples like ASU's eAdvisor, where they're doing degree planning, where you're getting visibility into a pathway for your major. You get, I'm going through these fast because I'm not going to be able to read these anyway. But you get to see all the way to graduation what are the critical requirements. If you try and enroll in a course and you say, you've just put yourself from the 4-year plan to the 5-year plan, you sure you want to do that? You might want to go see an advisor if so. They put the critical requirements up front, the courses that they know if you don't pass, you won't complete that major. If you can fail them once. If you fail them twice, you have to change majors. There are also no undeclared majors. There are exploratory majors in particular areas. Austin Peay has this as well. They're called macro majors. And so everybody gets a degree plan. Everybody's on a path to completion. And they've reached back into the Maricopa County Community Colleges as well. So everybody has a path even before you transfer in. What this really helps is just-in-time enrollment management. They know 3 semesters out how many sections they're going to need. And so they can be much more efficient with their classroom spaces and faculty time. And then once you know who's on the path and what path they should be on, you can do a lot more with predictive analytics and know who's starting to fall off that path. And so they've got a predictive model. These are the 9 factors on the right that they found correlate. And their advisors get these hot lists. Right? A student, you know, interesting one is, did you send your transcript somewhere, number 8? Right? If you send your transcripts, you're probably on your way out the door. That's a good thing to know. Let's reach out to that student. And they went from 22% to 91% of students who are on track. They've increased their year-to-year, first-year retention by about 8 percentage points, but it wasn't easy. It's taken years. These are some of the features that we see in these approaches to create more guided pathways for students to succeed. The way I think about it is a college green on a traditional college campus. There are 1,000 ways to cross that green. But you know what? We cut 4 or 5 because they're the most efficient way to get from the dining hall to the dorm, from the library to the classroom. Those are the mostly used paths. Let's expose those. Let's help students get on those paths. Always let them to opt out if it's not the right fit for them. But let's take some of the guesswork out. And there's a lot of the behavioral economists and choice architects who would say, in fact, people do best when you have 7 to 9 choices. If you only have 1 or 2, it feels like you're too constrained. If you have more than that, it's overwhelming and it's paralyzing, and you feel bad no matter what you chose because you see all the things you didn't choose. Right? So that's Goldilocks. Not too many choices, not too few, with an intentionality, with a purpose, help students get on those tracks and intervene when they start to get off. We're also doing some interesting work pushing the next envelope of this with WICHE, Predictive Analytics Reporting Framework, where institutions are federating, it's now up to 16 institutions, are federating their student data to look for these enrollment patterns, to look for pathways that nobody even knew were there. If you get enough data, and they're closing in on 1 million student records, can you do different types of more Google-style analytics, more cluster analysis? You don't even know what to look for. You don't know that your Latina chemistry transfer students with 10 to 15 credit hours who cross-enroll with a local community college are the ones who are not succeeding. So they're pushing the envelope on that. All right, let me get to moonshots. All right, so hopefully folks remember this quote from John F. Kennedy. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. So I like to edit the quote slightly. Say, we choose to provide high-quality, affordable education at scale, not because it is easy, but because it is hard. And a lot of what we're starting to see is new, entirely new, programmatic or even institutional models emerging that take some of these different technologies, solutions, pedagogical approaches, learning science, and putting them together and say, let's reimagine the teaching and learning moment. Let's reimagine a student's progression through their degree program. Let's reimagine then how we organize the institution around it. Let's reimagine how we fund the model. And can we do that and unlock a level of quality at a certain price point that we've up until now not been able to see? We have a program in partnership with EDUCAUSE called the Next Generation Learning Challenges. We just concluded the third wave of that program focused on these breakthrough models. We challenged people to say high completion rate, affordable cost, $5,000 price and cost, scalability, and have a clear approach to quality as we know how hard that is to measure. These are some of the institutions that are participating in that. There's a couple of themes to draw from this. One is it helps to have a blue logo, I think. But aside from that, it's very interesting to see the types of institutions that are participating in these conversations, and it has changed dramatically in the last 12 to 18 months. This is the University of Washington. This is the University System of Georgia. This is the Kentucky Community Technical College System. Right? This is innovation from within. These are institutions who say, we need to try something different. Let's create a competency-based nursing program. Let's try an accelerated degree completion program for all some college, no degree alumni. And they're putting together very interesting things. And one of the other things that I think they're doing is, let me tell a little vignette. I showed you those pictures of those kids of mine. And I was on Target doing something totally different. I started getting stuff like this, baby sale. It's like, how do they know I got babies, you know? Like, well, this feels like Amazon, doesn't it? So I looked it up. Do you know who for the last 10 years has run Target.com? Amazon. Target just took it over this past year. But for 10 years, they had a contract in place. And it got me thinking. And it made me think about disruptive innovation and Clay Christensen, right? Which is to say, remember in the late 90s when Amazon was going to put all the brick-and-mortar retailers out of business? Now, not great if you're Borders or even Barnes & Noble, but the last decade's been a great decade for Target and for Walmart and others. And so, you know, did we see Amazon disrupt those brick-and-mortar institutions? Or did we see really creative partnerships? Think about Target.com. These are two head-to-head competitors. They're saying, look, Amazon does great on this back-end stuff. Target's got deals with Martha Stewart. They've got brick-and-mortar places. You can come in. You can touch and feel the product. That's a really interesting partnership. And so more and more we're seeing people use partnerships to do this more quickly, to do this at scale, and to recognize complementary skill sets, knowing that no one can do everything perfectly well. What are some of the common features of these models? We're seeing a lot of use of prior learning assessment, competency, deep use of analytics, badges, interim milestones, giving people rewards along the way to show progression. Connective media, this is a great term I stole from the new Cornell dean of the Manhattan in New York City, the project that Cornell is doing there. He said it's not social media. Social media implies it's about, you know, playing volleyball and going to the chess club. It's connective media. That's the power. And how do we, you know, leverage sort of peer-to-peer learning in that? So we're starting to see those models. I said no one's using all of these, and no one's figured out the formula, but everybody's using at least half of these. And so we're seeing really interesting combinations of whole models being put together. And hopefully, you know, this time next year we'll be able to come back and report back even more. So those are the three leading innovations: Bigfoot, Goldilocks, moonshots. Right? Personalized learning that drives higher quality outcomes at an affordable price. Choice that's structured enough to help students get through to their goal but gives people the control and autonomy over their program. And moonshots, whole programs that have a fundamentally different delivery structure and therefore have a totally different set of outcomes. So let me conclude with this challenge that I promised you, which is I studied economics, and so I'll bore you with a chart here, which says, I think this is the challenge. This is where we are today. Whatever we're spending, we're getting a certain amount of education for. I have no way to quantify the education. Is it the number of is it the access we have, the quality, the completions, whatever it is? But I can tell you what we're spending. It's about $450 billion a year in higher education. Here's the great risk: that all this great technology, all the great innovation here at EDUCAUSE leads us to a place where we have 80% of the education for 50% of the cost. I could conceive of that happening. I think that the strategies are there, the political pressure, the budget cuts. You can start to imagine where this isn't such a far-off reality. That all the you know, another way to ask this question is, what are the productivity gains for? What are we going to use this for? If we're getting time back from students, if we're getting time back from faculty, we're getting resources back from the institutions, how do we reallocate those things? What do we do with that? Do we just refill the state coffers so we can build more prisons or pay for health care costs? I hope not. So here's the opportunity, which is to say, how do we actually get 120% of the education for maybe 80% of the cost? Right? Isn't this the great ideal? Could we actually take this moment, this opportunity, to address the challenges of quality, of what students are getting out of this, of equity and how many students we're letting in and how many students are getting through? Can we get to that point? But this will require a grand partnership. A grand partnership between folks who are focused on business model innovation and those who are focused on learning model innovation. The promoters of innovation, everything new and everything in the future is good. And the protectors of quality, everything in the past is good. Right? We need a love child between those two. You know, those two stories, those two narratives. We have to think about the instructional model. We have to think about faculty engagement. We have to create a win-win for faculty in this conversation. We have to think about high technology combined with high touch. There's a lot we cannot replace. There is the most important things that only humans can do on the faculty side, on the advising side. That's what we need to design our systems to maximize. We need to think about design and R&D, but also think about scaling. And we need both traditional institutions getting better every day, and we need to be thinking about breaking the model, putting it back together, the breakthrough ideas here. We need these things to come together. So that's my challenge I'll leave you with. It's an honor to be here. Again, I say these are just things that you all in this room are doing. I'm playing them back to you. I like to end with this quote, which is Teddy Roosevelt's quote about the man in the arena. I am not the man in the arena. You all are. And so it's a real privilege to be here with you all, and I thank you for having me, and happy to take a couple questions if we have time. So we have a couple mics up front if people want to fire any questions, or I can just tell jokes. All right. Janelle, you want to come to the microphone? Or?
So you, at the end, referred a little bit to Clay Christensen's work. And so I'm curious, from your perspective at the 100,000 foot, are we going to be a borders, or are we going to be a target that partners? You know, will we be disrupted and go away and something will replace it, or are we going to actually innovate and change?
Yeah. I both would like to think and do think that we'll be more like target.com than borders. But I think there will be some borders along the way. So I think that I don't believe we're going to be shuttering a lot of institutions and boarding up windows and everyone's going to be learning online and we'll put microchips in and then we'll all be done. I think that there will be some pain and reformulation of institutions, and I think in the public institutions, we'll see administration maybe combine more. We're starting to see some kind of, it's almost like public mergers and acquisitions, where SUNY's gone to multiple presidents and over single presidents over multiple campuses. I think for some institutions, they may be caught in that borders moment. I heard a quote, which I'm not sure I totally believe in, but I think it's an interesting one, really in reference to newspapers. He said, the newspaper industry died in 1999, it took a decade for us to figure it out, right? It had to kind of play out. And they said, there's probably 500 colleges or universities that are already out of business. They just don't know it yet. And so there may be a little bit of that, but I think that the core of higher ed, because of the difficulty in measuring quality, the regulated market, I think that more of it will transition and these innovation from within than a full disruptive innovation. That's an ongoing debate I have with Michael Horn and Clay.
Great, thanks.
So let's go here, and where'd you go?
All of this is very disruptive for institutions and their traditional ways of operating. And I'm thinking about funding, and I'm wondering, do you think that there's a disruption that needs to happen in terms of government funding of education at a federal level, state level? Do they need to be partners with us in reimagining?
Yeah, I think both at the public policy level and then at the consumer funding level, there's interesting different things happening. I think we will see funding with under certain conditions. And so a lot of states are going to performance-based funding, and I think we still need to figure out those models. There seem like there's some good ways to do that, and there seem like there's some pretty cavalier ways to do that. So I think we'll see state funding go to more partnership where, you get rewarded for success, and so the incentives are aligned. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Pell. So Pell is facing a $6 billion shortfall in 2014. And so how do we make the most of those resources? Do we put more strings on those so that we get the bigger bang for the buck? I think that's an open question, one that we at the foundation are wrestling with and trying to engage with folks on. I think at the other end, when you start to get cost to a point where folks, I've heard people say, what if you funding higher ed looks more like paying a cable bill than buying an automobile? And if I'm paying about $100 a month, am I making different decisions? And so there's some folks, University Now, who I mentioned, they don't take Title IV dollars. They're trying to get down to a price point that's low enough that you don't have to deal with the headaches of compliance and to get to more of that subscription model. So I think we're going to start to see more subscription-based modeling or try-before-you-buy type of innovations at the kind of lowest cost. And so you see things like Straighter Line and others who are kind of pioneering some of those funding. But I think the funding models will evolve. You're right.
So I had the opportunity to work as a consultant with Walden University to develop an online PhD program that was problem-based learning. And what I found interesting about working with this university was when we would sit down in powwow, there would be 10 people at the table. There were two or three curriculum designers, there were media folks, so a very significant team to put together really high-quality problem-based learning deliveries. And that's because they don't have any brick and mortar to pay for. So they can put a lot of money into very, very creative approaches and creative pedagogies. I'm really concerned that for the average university, they don't have teams like that to put together media specialists who can design really cool online kinds of things. I'd like you to respond to what I think is a really significant challenge in the design of innovative pedagogies, not just talking heads giving lectures and some stuff.
Yeah, so two thoughts. The folks at OLI like to quote Herb Simon, who's the Nobel laureate, and who said, improvement in post-secondary education will only come when we change from teaching as a solo sport to a team-based research activity, right? Which really is that integrated team. And OLI has subject matter experts, human-computer interaction experts, instructional designers, and it's those teams who are creating that. So I think that I totally agree with you that no one person can master the range of skills that we need today, either in the discipline, understanding pedagogy, understanding the technology, and so we have to go to more of a team-based approach. I think institutions, brick and mortar, whoever they are, need to be making those types of evolutions. I think it also brings in the question of Brad Wheeler at Indiana University, talks about above the campus. What do we have to do above the campus? Sometimes those teams, we can't do it all ourselves. If we're trying to find the world-class team from who we can cobble together from our different departments so that we get to have 10 people in a room too, right, we're rarely going to build the world-class product. And so I think we have to figure out how we create partnerships either across campuses or leverage things where we're building things once and figuring out how to localize and customize them locally. We're starting to see some of that with digital assets around textbooks. I think you start to mix and match and OER. And I think we have to, the biggest challenge, and Ithaca did another report, so barriers to barrier to interactive online learning in post-secondary, something like that. And they really sat with faculty administrators and looked at what are the challenges to not just online, but using this technology to transform instructional models. And they went through and laid out a lot of things. And one was around, we don't have the platforms to have that flexibility yet. But there's just the cultural change of, you know, that I should be proud to have a, be part of a national network that teaches physics rather than my physics class, you know, is my identity. Going to be a big cultural shift, and I think that some of the progress of institutions who are able to move more aggressively and nimbly will put pressure to say, we can't do it all alone. Some of our funding, we've deliberately funded people with not enough money and too short a time period so that they have to go find partnerships elsewhere. Say, oh, I'll give you $1 million in 3 years. Oh, great. I'm going to start buying servers and building something locally. Give them $200,000 in 18 months. They start finding partnerships. Yeah, Janelle, and then over here, Janelle's been waiting for.
Josh, in light of what we all experienced last night in this country, what impact do you think Washington will have on Bigfoot, Goldilocks, and the moon in the next 4 years?
I prognosticate on a lot of things, and that's probably not one. But I think that there's some things that the department's been talking about. So there's something called First in the World, which is a program that they're trying to develop, similar to the I-3 funding K-12, which would be much smaller, but sort of $50 million, I think they're talking, $100 million maybe out of FIPSI. That really would be an innovation fund. Trying to say, if you want to be first in the world, what's it going to take to get there? I think that will be a stimulus fund. There's also some talk of race to the top for higher ed. And I don't know how that would turn out. I don't think that the playbook is well-defined yet. So I get nervous about trying to instantiate too much of, oh, let's all do it this way, and let's use big dollars to get whole things moving in one direction. But I guess I would say I'm cautiously optimistic. I saw a quote from Arne Duncan who said, I will be back in a second term if there is one, and my focus will be on higher ed affordability. So I think they're going to pay attention to it.
Hi. At the college I'm at, we do a lot of tutorial work, both at the undergraduate and the graduate level. And one of the things we're grappling with is an embedded assessment because of accountability demands. We're expected to show numbers of students served and all that. And then just looking at GPAs or course completion or credit accumulation isn't enough to satisfy those who fund. They want embedded assessments. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, it kind of gets back to that closed loop of learning I mentioned, of getting to that granular learning outcome. That really says, let's embed those assessments, let's track them. You know, that's the, you know, in some ways, I don't know how far off that is to be able to do that effectively. I don't know what the barriers are. We're really trying to learn a lot more about that, working with folks who are really getting into the competency space and mapping out competencies. Western Governors, Capella, there's a whole set of institutions that have been doing this for a number of years, and more who are trying to do that. But it is a significant investment to develop those competency maps, calibrate them, you know, for your local institution, come up with the assessments, embed them in whatever that learning experience is. And so I don't think we have the foundational content or technology to make that easy yet, but it's something that I think we're headed in that direction to be sure. And, you know, love to learn more about what you guys are actually doing, how far you think we are.
Is there any analysis done on what is a degree for? Is it to obtain a job? Is it what is it for? How many of the university courses are actually fulfilling those needs? And whether there are a lot of those courses, programs that are completely useless in terms of what they're supposed to achieve? And is there an attempt to reduce cost in that approach?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of trade-offs in there. And I think that one of the strengths of higher ed is the dynamism and diversity that we have, right? The reason these innovations are emerging is because of that dynamism and diversity. And so I think there's, you know, reason to be trying to find the balance of how do we articulate what we're trying to accomplish but not be reductionist and not be homogenous and all of those things. So I think we need frameworks for doing that. I think that the AACNU's LEAP framework and Lumina's degree qualification profile are starting to get at rubrics and frameworks that allow you to start to articulate what do we think the student needs to know for our institution, consistent with our mission, but you know, creates enough of a fungibility and a connection so that you can have a conversation across multiple institutions, say, all right, in that category, how did you think about and approach it? I don't know if it's granular enough. I almost think we need to be supported with the really granular technology capabilities that would have, you know, the library of learning outcomes, tagged to assessments, tagged to content, that you could say, well, my learning map looks like this, or I'm going to start with, you know, an institution that I respect, and I'm going to tweak it 20%, and then I'm going to know where things are already tagged and can build off of that. If you have to build each of these things from the bottom up. So I kind of think those meta frameworks like LEAP and DQP paired with some of the technology that allows the meta tagging semantic analysis might get us to a place where we can manage those things without being reductionist and leading to kind of a NCLB like, you know, here's the thing that everybody needs to learn. But it's probably wishful thinking, or maybe it's 15 years away. Sure. Maybe the last question?
I can't resist making a comment. I'm sorry. You shared a lot of great innovations today. And, you know, there are a lot of those that you funded that are openly available to all institutions, and in particular the OLI courses from Carnegie Mellon and the new CCOLI courses are innovations that any of us here could begin using immediately. The NROC math course, there's a lot of the things you talked about today that rather than institutions building the broad teams, they can take advantage of reusing that work.
Thank you for saying that, and I should have made that point more strongly, because that is absolutely the case. And we're trying to lower the barriers as much as possible to doing this kind of thing, trying it, put a toe in the water. And higher, we don't like to jump into the deep end of the pool, but we got to get our feet wet, right? So there's lots of ways to try and get your feet wet. And it's been a frustration how the pace of scale of OLI, which is decades of learning science, these best world-class teams we talked about, and they have a few thousand, tens of thousands of students, and then MOOCs in a month, you know, or in 6 months have a million learners. That's another love child we need, right? The MOOC distribution channel with the actual pedagogical learning science rigor of OLI to match those pieces up. But you're absolutely right that a lot of this is trying to lower the barriers, and so, you know, that we have to go faculty by faculty by faculty to convince them. We can't fund that. There's no sort of vehicle to do that. We don't have a sales channel for those things. And so anyway, I thank you for saying that, but there are ways to get your toes in the water. All right, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.